Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and I'm so pleased to be able to bring to you today a delightful woman that I became familiar with via a film. And it's the movie Infinity, and it was done by Sharon Rose and her associates. And after I saw the movie, I said, I would really like to meet the woman that you interviewed, Renate Dollinger, and is there a way I can be in touch? And Sharon said, oh, absolutely. She lives up in your neck of the woods, and you're going to be able to meet her. And when you talk to her, let me know, because I just think she's a very special person. So I want to welcome to the show Renate Dollinger, who is a world-renowned artist. Not only that, but she's got a wonderful sense of humor, and she's 87 years young, and she's an example for all of us. Welcome to the show, Renate.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure having you. You know, we were laughing and cutting up because you said that you're probably going to be doing your paintings even when you're dead, at the rate the commissions are coming in to you, and that you figure that you'll probably push them out every periodically from the grave and just say, look, the price, it's on the back. And I just really love that because you have such a wonderful sense of humor. You're so down to earth. And when I had a chance to meet you 2 weeks ago, it was even more fun because not only did I have a chance to chat with you one-on-one, but also to see your art. And it's so brilliantly colorful. And you're painting all of the time.
Yes. Yes, I am. I am painting all the time, practically all the time. I live in a senior establishment, and I have the choice of playing cards, which I'm terrible at, or painting, because there isn't that much to do anymore when you're 87. I mean, I can't go out.
That's not your case.
Okay.
Right. You're very, very dynamic. Renate, when I first saw you in the film, Infinity, it was your story that really grabbed my mind and my heart. And that's why I wanted to meet you in person, because so many times we see people that are in a film, or maybe they're speaking, they're in front of us, we know that they're accomplished in a special way, as you are with your art, and then we don't learn anything about what they have been through to get to where they are. And people all over the world are well aware of your painting. And I wanted you to share with my audience your story. You survived the Holocaust. You and your sister and every other member of your family was killed.
Yeah.
But the story about a very special man who came into your life. I'd like for you to share that, because you were, I believe, was it in London where this man walked into a coffee shop, a perfect stranger?
Oh, you mean the angel?
Yes.
It was a tea shop, and it was in London. It was in southern part of London called, I can't remember the name of the coffee shop or the tea shop, but it was in, I remember, in Hampstead. I'm now of an age where every now and then I lose a word or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's like having hiccups of the brain. You know, it goes away, it comes back. But that is, Hampstead. Do you want me to tell him about the angel coming, or do you want
to
tell?
No, I'd
the
love
angel.
For you to tell that, because at that time, you were in London. First, how did you get to London? You had been in Germany. You spoke German. How were you able to avoid the Holocaust? How did you get to London?
How did it all start? Well, I was 9 years old when the Nazis came into power in Germany. And the very first one they killed was my father. They killed him on New Year's Eve. They shot him right through the window when he was sitting there in his chair. And that was New Year's Eve. And they were supposed to go, my mother, my father were supposed to go and see the operetta called the Fledermaus. Anybody that goes to operas will know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Well, the Fledermaus was playing that night, New Year's Eve. And my mother said, oh, Otto, she said, come, come, come. And he said, no, I don't feel so good today. Why don't you go, Katie? What's her name? And she said, oh, without it, I won't like it. But she went. And he sat in his chair looking at the snow and at the big, large window to the garden. And they shot him right through the window. They found the next morning there were the footprints. And that was the beginning of the Nazi era. That was 1933, New Year's Eve. And the reason I know this for sure, this is a weird story coming, is because I went to bed. I was in bed. I was 9 years old. And all of a sudden, my father walked in, and he lifted me up, and he said, goodbye, Renate. And then he walked out of the window on the second floor through the glass. And I've never gotten over it. How did he do that? But I figured out now that I'm so old that he was dead, and there was a spirit living.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that so well. I never forgot that. Anyhow, so the next morning it was all mayhem, and father was dead, and my sister Steffi had to come back from Breslau to be in Brieg. The town was Brieg, B-R-I-E-G, Brieg, in Silesia. I tell you, my father owned, actually, there were two sons. There was Otto and Fritz, and both of them owned a mill, a textile mill. My father owned the one in Brieg, and my uncle owned the one in Freistadt. And that the whole town worked at the mill, practically. And my mother, who was an ardent socialist, had one of the buildings for the factory children, you know, because everybody worked in the mill, so mm-hmm. the children shouldn't be alone. So she had a huge house that she used as a school. I used to go there myself, and it's like a preschool, like you would call a preschool nowadays. But mm-hmm. there they went and they washed their hands, and they sang songs, and they played in the sandbox. It was a very nice place, actually. I know because I was there. Ask me some more.
Okay. Well, this experience with your father,
yes,
was so vivid to you. It's right there with you. But this was
yes.
a precursor of things to come. So you were yes. 9 when you were in 1933.
I was 9 years old. When
9 years old.
9 years old. And the next day, which was so terrible, they told me, go and ice skate on the little pond and don't come home until evening, until it gets dark. And I did. I went around and around and around and around on that pond. It was very boring. Hardly anybody was there. That was New Year's Day.
Mm-hmm.
So years went by, and we moved to Breslau. Breslau was the big town. Brieg was the little town. Because the Nazis came and they took away the mills. Actually, they offered some money to my mother, but it was so little that she said, oh, you must be kidding, or something in German like that. And
mm-hmm.
they took the mills without paying at all. They were
mm-hmm.
big. There were many, many buildings. So then we went with much less money to Breslau, where my mother got a job running an old age home in Breslau, which was ultra, ultra Orthodox Jewish. I mean, you couldn't imagine how Jewish it was. We didn't even carry the keys on Saturdays. On the train, going to Breslau, my mother, who was really a terrific woman, said to me, Renate, she said, you have 1 hour to become very Jewish. And I've never forgotten that. I remember saying to Mutter, I said, Mutter, how Jewish? She said, very.
Amazing.
And yeah, she was an amazing woman. So we went and moved into this big red brick building, which was the old age home, and who also, that time, had young ladies that worked in offices. So it was both. It was for old people and for young people. Like a
mm-hmm.
residence home. and she got the job running it as a what do you call it, as a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sister and I, we moved upstairs on the third floor, and we lived there. And I was then about 10 or 11. And then until I was 15, we lived right in that house that was first full of younger people, and then as people immigrated, they became more and more old. Because they wouldn't take the old people. Countries like America wouldn't take anybody anyhow. But England or South America, they said not the old people, just the young people.
Mm-hmm.
So then they didn't know what to do with the mothers and their fathers. So they used to go to my mother, who was an angel, and they used to say, "Ah, Frau Sandberger, they won't take my mother, they won't take my father and my grandfather. Can you put them up?" And she did. And so by the time I left at 15, there were something like 35 old people living there, four to each room, if you can imagine. I had to go every Friday night and say good Shabbos for Frau Müller. And they always cried whenever I went. I went from one crying lady to another crying lady.
My goodness.
How are you? Are you well? I'm so glad. That was my training.
Well, and it was good training.
It was good training. Also, the seminary students used to come over. There was a seminary nearby, practically two houses away, for young rabbis, and they used to come and eat in our place because it was very kosher. And now, they would mm-hmm. come and they would tell stories. That's why I illustrated, I wrote that book. You didn't even know about that. But I wrote that book called The Rabbi Who Flew. If mm-hmm. you go to the website, you'll see it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote that and illustrated it because of the young man, one of the rabbis who became a rabbi in Los Angeles later, was telling me about his great-grandfather who swore up and down that he knew a rabbi that could fly.
Now, you were there in this house until you were 15. So
right.
How did you get to London? Because all of your family...
I'm going to London in a minute. I'm now
okay.
15 with a terrible ear infection, and my mother comes home and she said, "Renata, you're going to London." And I said, "No." How? Well, she found out about the children's transport. It's called the Kinder Transport. Everybody that's Jewish knows about it. It was run by the Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
The Quakers took the children out, but they could only come and bring the train in the middle of the night, like between 12 and 1, I think, but 12 and 2. And then they had to take them away. And there were children, Jewish children, under 16. And I was barely 15. I was 15 in 1 month. And she... In a matter of 2 days, they packed me up, and with my ears still awful, they ran me because we couldn't use any transport. It was very bad with the Nazis during those years. There was nothing we could do. We couldn't buy food. We couldn't go to the movies. We couldn't go swimming. We couldn't walk on the sidewalk. I mean, there was everything was forbidden. So therefore, we couldn't walk on the sidewalk, but in the middle of the street, she ran me in the middle of the night all the way to the station where a train was standing there with full of children and mothers crying and young men saying, "Hurry up, hurry up, we have to leave, we have to leave." And on into the last caboose, the last train, my mother said, "Well," she said, "get in there, get in there. There's a little room." She pushed me up into the train and she said, "Auf Wiedersehen, Renate, you have to be your own mother from now on." And that was the last time I saw her. That's the story. That was literally the last time I saw my mother. And I was squished in with other children, and they were all at the window, and I couldn't get anywhere near the window, so I never even saw her again. And then the train began to move.
Wow.
And before it got to the border, the Nazis stopped it, and Germans stopped it, and said that it was gold on the train. And they began to make a huge examination and screaming and yelling, threw children off because they said there was gold. And they came to me, and they took my tiny little necklace off. They tore it off because gold. They were looking for gold. Anyhow, all of a sudden, the train began to move again and went into Holland, and there, it was only a little bit into Holland. There were a whole bunch of women standing outside the train, and they were throwing in the young men came. The train was run by Quakers. The Jews put the money out for AZA or Hadassah, and the Quakers actually drove the trains. And so he came in, he said, open all the windows, and then in came, you know, they threw sandwiches and hard-boiled eggs and apples into the train. Oh, it was great. We were going madly searching for salami sandwiches and egg sandwiches. Yeah, somebody had cheese sandwich. That wasn't going for so much, but anyhow. So that was my entrance into the other world.
Into
Holland.
Holland
was the first one. And
the story
after that...
Mm-hmm. And then you were in this tea shop in London.
That's years later.
All right.
I'm
how old
still
were
only
you?
15.
Okay, so
when I met the angel, 21.
Mm-hmm. You were 21.
I was in a refugee hostel. A refugee hostel picked me up. Then I was evacuated to a family called the Bartons in Watford. And then I ended up in art school because they got me a scholarship in London, in art school. Right, it was a polytechnic in London.
Wow.
Wow, yeah, it was very wow. Which I almost didn't get, but then I started to draw my little people. And he came in, the master teacher came in, and he picked it up, and he walked out. And matron from the refugee hostel came back, and she said, you've got a scholarship, Renata.
Oh, my goodness.
For the rest of your life, you're now in.
Wow.
And that was it. So then I was in that art school. But then came the war, and the place was bombed where I was living, and I ended up in the subway, in the underground. My girlfriend Helga and I, we lived in the underground, which was very nice, by the way. They had beds and storytellers and tea shops moving through the underground. It was like a whole world down there.
Wow.
We were all the way through the Blitz in London in the underground and didn't really come out of it until the heavy bombing stopped. And then we found out that the hospital was no more. It had burned down.
Mm-mm.
Now I'm 17. So at 17... I went to go look for a job, and I found my old job, which was where I was a secretary. And when I walked through the burning town of London, which was literally burning everywhere, I got to my job, and there was Mr. Kindler, who was my boss. And this is what he said to me. Renata, he said, you're the worst secretary I have ever known. In my whole life, only the fire is saving me from you.
What a way to greet somebody.
I said, I'm so sorry. I could never spell or learn how to type quite right. I'm really not in the profession. When I didn't have one yet at 17. I did go to art school. But anyhow, so this was... When he was standing, I still see him standing there. The building behind him was burning, and he gave that speech to me. Word for word, that's what he said.
That is
right.
Funny. That is funny.
I then realized that that wasn't going to be my future as a secretary. And
absolutely not.
Absolutely not. So I got another job. I got so many jobs that I can tell you that I practically worked on everything, except I was never a prostitute.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, I considered it, but I was afraid my mother was going to find out.
Those were tough times. We're laughing, but those
and, you
were
know,
very...
Were, yeah, I know. Well, they were. They were tough times. But anyhow, so life went on. Then I joined the Land Army, and that was when I was 18. And the Land Army took over in England when the young men were all called up. So mm-hmm. you had a choice, the Land Army, the ATS, or the Navy. And the Navy and the ATS, they usually wanted English girls. But the Land Army didn't mind so much if you had an accent, because to milk a cow, you could do with an accent.
I don't think the cows cared, really.
No, they didn't. They really didn't. So I was stationed on a farm, and I milked, and I cut down trees. So we did all of that. And the years went by, and now I'm going, it is almost time for the V-Day, which is 1945. And I was 21, almost 21, not quite. And I was stationed near London, and I took the bus to London, all the way to Hampstead, and then to the tea shop, which was empty with the door wide open, and it was V-Day. V-Day was a victory day in Europe. You could hear all the horns tooting, and I go and sit down at the table, and I ordered a mushroom omelette. And I knew the omelettes were all from dried eggs. So... They said, there was nobody, but there was nobody in this. It was a little tiny coffee shop or tea shop. There was not a single person sitting at the tables. There were maybe five or six tables, what you call a hole in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the door was wide open. It was a sunny day, and in walked a tall Air Force officer, and he was the angel. Okay, ask me some more.
All right. Now, when I was talking with you, you said that this was a very handsome-looking young man.
Yes.
And that he was dressed in a officer's uniform.
Correct.
Like an English pilot. But you said his face looked very, very pasty, very white. It's almost like he had no blood in his body. It was just...
Well, he had blood, but he was pale. And he had mm-hmm. very long, white fingers. And he had very blue eyes. I remember that after he sat down, which I thought was a nerve, right opposite me at this table when all the others were unoccupied.
And, then what happened?
He said to me, "Hello, Renata." And I said, "Hello." And I said, "How do you know my name?" He said, "Oh, I know everything about you." That made me uneasy. I always felt mm-hmm. people shouldn't know everything about me. A little is okay, but not too much.
So gotcha.
Yeah. So he said that, and I said, "Oh." He said, "I came to tell you that your whole family is dead." That was the first thing he said.
Mm.
I said, "Not my sister." "No," he said, "not your sister. Your mother saved your sister, but everybody, your uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews, everybody has been killed. Everybody." I mean, it was a large family with many, 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 what we call a mishpoch, many relatives, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were many aunts and uncles and nephews and nieces and all of that, that a large family is. They were all killed. I said, "But I'd never heard that. You see, where I was working, in the way out in the country, we had not even any newspapers, hardly anything, except the little local ones. So nobody told me this was going on, and I was immediately angry with him. I said, "How do you know, and how can you tell me something so awful?" And he said, "He knows because he saw them." I said, "How can you see them when they're all dead in Germany and you're sitting here in London?" He said, "I saw them because they're all over on the other side resting." I said, "Come on." Anyhow, so then I looked at him and I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Nothing." So I said, "How can you see them?" I said, "I bet you didn't see my mother." He said, "Yes, I did." I said, "So what was she doing?" He said, "Sleeping." I said, "You didn't cover her. She's always cold. My mother was always cold, no matter what you put on top of her." So he said, "No, she has a cover on." I said, "What color was it?" I remember saying that, and he said, "Blue." "Really?" I said, "You're really alive, but they're dead?" He said, yes, there is no death. Death is nothing. There is just a separation from one way to another, from one way of living to another kind. And so he began to tell me what it's all about, how you go, when you die, you go to astral, where you look at what you have learned or what you would like to still learn. And it's like you're sitting there with help. And then I said to him, are you an angel? And he said, no. And I said, but how can you see him do all that? He said, I'm a heavenly social worker.
A heavenly social worker.
A heavenly social worker. I said, isn't that an angel? He said, sort of. I said, what kind is that? He said, it's sort of a what you call, guardian angel. We work with the people, humans.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I said, are there lots of them? He said, oh, yes, it's a hard work, lots of jobs. I have many cases. I said, you have cases? He said, yes. Who else do you have outside of me? I said. He said, a girl that lost her legs during the bombing, and I go see her at night. I said, really, it's amazing. And then I said, and where's your wings? He said, I don't have any wings. I don't need wings. I said, how do you move from place to place? He said, when I think where I want to be, that's where I am. And then I asked him the very most important question, as far as I was concerned, at 21. Are angels born as cute little angels and then become large angels? He said, no. He said, angels are when God says. That's it. I said, you mean you don't get born little and get big? No. He said, are you Jewish? I asked. He said, no. I said, are you Christian? He said, no. I said, so what are you? He said, different. Really? I said, different.
Well,
I remember so many of those questions I asked. I said, well, no, he was not this, he was not that. And so I said, what happens when you get old? He said, we don't get old. No, I said, how nice. So do you die when God wants you to be gone? That's when you're gone. I said, that doesn't sound like a good job. He said, well, I remember that.
Oh, I love it.
Well, no, but I remember thinking that that's not such a good job. I mean, you know, you don't get born, you don't get die, and when God suddenly has a moment in which he's irritated, you're gone. So, anyhow,
amazing.
We spent two and a half days together. We literally walked through London and everything. When it got to be evening, the first day I managed to remember, there was a hostel nearby in Hampstead, and I went over there to find out if they have a bed. But I asked him, how am I going to find you again? He said, just think of me. I said, it's not going to work. He said, it's going to work. So I came out the next day, and there was a lot of to-do in London at that time. Big tooting cars and a lot of people in the streets. And so I just thought of his name. Oh, I asked him, what's your name? He said, John Score. Which I doubt very much was his real name. Score means many.
Mm-hmm.
John was his first name. So there I thought of John, and there he was. It seemed like the people parted in front of me, and there was John, tall John, pale, mm-hmm. with long white fingers. He said, here I am. You see that? It worked. And so I spent 2.5 days with him. The last time I saw him, we were sitting on a bench in Hampstead Heath. That's a park in London. And he said, I've told you everything, and I told you where you have to go to now and what's going to happen. And you just follow all, like I tell you, and don't worry about being in the Land Army. You go and join the American Third Army now and become an interpreter. And don't worry about when you find out that your family is no more. They're just still doing fine. They're just on a different dimension.
Amazing.
I said, they're not dead. No, they're not dead, Renata. They have told you they're not dead. Okay? And
we're
going
to, Renata, let me just stop you right there, dear, because then we're going to find out how you were informed about your painting, but we're going to take a break for just a minute. Will you stay with me?
Yes.
Stay with me.
I'm going to have a little bit of water, yeah.
Yes, that'll be fine. This is Renata Dollinger, a world-renowned artist. We're going to find out how she was told her future by this tall, handsome stranger.
Hale.
John Spore was his name. We'll come back in just a moment, yes, to listen to the rest of this wonderful woman's story. It's the real thing, folks. It is not made up. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Rio. I'm the author of the cutting-edge book, Hooked on Raw. I want to give you and your loved ones the gift of optimum health. So when you order my book, Hooked on Raw, which has over 350 delicious, healthy recipes, I'll include my new DVD, What's Not Cooking in Rio's Kitchen, for a half price. Just go to my website, rawfoodinfo.com, and click on Holiday Special. That's rawfoodinfo.com. Click on Holiday Special.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo. My special guest today is world-renowned artist Renata Dollinger. And this is a woman whose life, if you are just tuning in, this is a story, her story, about an angel who said he wasn't an angel. And we're going to be hearing the rest of this phenomenal story because it was how she was told what she was going to be doing for the rest of her life. Renata, let's go on now. You've gotten this information, and he's... What did he tell you right at the end?
And I said goodbye. I said goodbye to John. In fact, I said, don't go away, John. But he said, I'm going. And I said, why couldn't you stay longer? He said, I'm leaving. And he left. But I then went to Baker Street, and I got taken into the Third Army as an interpreter after lots of testing and stationed in France, and then this big, huge troop of the occupation group, all the GIs that did the occupation of Germany were all getting ready to enter under Patton, General Patton. And in the very, very end of this huge troop of trucks and trucks and trucks, hundreds of trucks, was a little tiny truck, which called a half truck, with 6 interpreters in it, and we were the interpreters. There were 3 boys and 3 girls, and we were taken to do the, translations.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to open up the camps, and we were stationed near Munich. And Pullach, I remember the name, Pullach, yeah. So that was my next job. I'm now 21. And I was very excited with a new uniform that I was wearing. And all those GIs, and there were very few girls. It was what I thought a wonderful way to be. There were hardly any women, and they weren't allowed to have anything to do with German ladies. So we were it. Three ladies and mm-hmm. hundreds of GIs. I was not worried about finding my mother anymore, but I did hear some awful stories that I had to translate of the ones that we were, we entered Munich, and there was Dachau. We opened that up, and we opened up another couple of them. And I was very young, and I heard some terrible stories, and I saw some terrible sights. And I was really very shook up by it. But I was also very young. So we had dances at night, and during the day I absorbed so many terrible stories, so many horrible things. But I swallowed them all in like you would swallow a beef stew or something. And much later, when all of those 2 years were up, I was 2 years with the American Army as an interpreter, 2 years. And I had I was a warrant officer, 2 years. And then I was invited to come to the United States, which is amazing because nobody invites you, but I didn't have to go through any number and anything. There was a phone call saying, if you want to come now to the United States, there is no transportation available.
Wow.
So there was a ticket I could have come. I went to pick up the ticket in England, and then, first of all, I have to explain to you that I screw up very often. I picked up all my papers, stayed in a lovely little hotel before I would go to France to get on my ship that goes to New York. And then I left everything behind on the table in the little hotel. So in the train going to France, I suddenly remembered, where are my papers? My papers, my ticket, my everything. And my, I did have my what do you call it, leaving the army, the armed forces. I had that.
Your discharge papers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had those, thank God. Mm-hmm. But I left everything. I left all the invitation papers and the ticket and everything on the table at the motel. It was a little hotel in Hampstead. Right. And it was too late. I was already in the south of France. So when we got to Cannes, I went to the shipping office and I cried. I cried and cried and cried, and in walked this old bearded gentleman. He was probably only 40, but to me looked old, an old man in uniform with a beard. And he said, I'm here. He was the captain of the cruise ship Sovietsky. You didn't even know that, did you, Donna?
Mm-mm.
Anyhow, he said, what's going on? And he said, she didn't have any papers. She forgot all the papers and the ticket for the ship that's leaving for New York. And so he said to me, darling, he said, why did you do that? I said, I was in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you left everything behind, yes. He said, would you like to go on our cruise ship? We're going to New York. I said, yes, but yes, he said, it's going to take a long time because we're going to visit all kinds of islands and go to Cuba and we go here, we go there, and you cannot leave the ship at all. I said, I have absolutely no money because I went out just before I got there to buy myself a bikini. I was thinking that we're going, that there was going to be a pool on the ship. So I have, he said, why don't you just come on my ship? And there is a lady, there was supposed to be a companion lady, and she didn't make it, so she's all alone in her, there was a second-class state room, and you could help her out a little bit if she needs someone. I said, oh, I'd be glad to do that. You wouldn't mind? No, I wouldn't mind at all, I said. In fact, I'd love it. And why don't you just take your stuff now and follow me? This is how I went to America on a cruise ship.
Now,
are you surprised, Don?
Yes,
surprised.
I am. I am surprised. But it just shows you that it's almost like you were under a magic awning.
Yes,
but
I was.
You
I
were
was
told,
always.
Yeah. You were told by your angel, as you like to call him.
Yeah.
You were told by him that you were going to be doing painting. And
oh, you want me to talk? Yes. He told me I was going to be a very well-known painter. But you will do the paintings of your people that were living in little villages called shtetls. And that I didn't even know what that was. I said, really? Yes. Well, he said, you're going to be doing that, and you will be very well known for that. I said, all right. I was, anyhow, I arrived in America, and I got a job. My sister was there, married to a rabbi, and my aunt picked me up. And I had a wonderful time, by the way, for 3 weeks on that cruise ship. Oh, it was wonderful. It was, oh, the food. And the lady was darling, was having another little mother with you. I had such a good time. I can't remember when I had such a good time. So I arrived and went to California. And then the real big thing happened. I met my husband. After I was supposed to actually meet another husband to be, but I didn't like him. But my husband came out of nowhere, and there he was, and I fell in love with him. And his parents were lovely, and the rabbi was informed, and his rabbi was informed, and there I was with the perfect man, Jerry Dollinger, my husband. And yeah, I got married. And started to paint and paint and paint and have a wonderful time. But I painted landscapes. I wasn't painting what I was meant to paint. Then when I was 42 years old, now time's going on, you see. I'm now 42. 42 years old and living in Palo Alto. So there comes, and I had a little gallery in Palo Alto. And into my gallery walks this really strange woman, very large, with a huge, big, brown circle on her forehead. And I said to her, what's your name? She said, Dixie. And I said, Dixie? Yes. And she said, every day she came on a chair in my gallery, and she wouldn't talk. She didn't buy anything. All she said to me was, the master said, you have to close the gallery. And I thought she was putting a curse on it. So now I told Jerry, you know, that woman is coming. He said, we cannot keep the gallery open because the rent is due and we're going to have to close it. Well, I said, that Dixie woman is saying that I have to close it. Well, we closed the gallery, and then I went home and the phone rang, and it was Dixie from San Jose. She said, the master said that she can now come and tell me why we closed the gallery. Well, she came all the way from San Jose. Now, you know Palo Alto and San Jose is about an hour apart. Mm-hmm. She drove all the way up. We made tea. We sat down. I said, now tell me, what's this all about? She said, the master, by the way, who I never found out who it was, the master said that you had lived before in a small town called the Shtetl in Eastern Europe. There, with your mother, you were selling vegetables on the market. And whenever people walk by, you drew their pictures. You drew the pictures in the wet dirt underneath the table because the water was trickling down. When your mother was watering the vegetables on the table, it trickled down. That was your palette down below. You made all the paintings. You drew the rabbi and the people and everything. You were like the town drawer down underneath the table. And she used to have a fit. That old mother from her former life, she said, don't draw. It's against the law for Jews to make images of God. Man is made in the image of God, and you must not make an image of him. And so she used to take her foot and wipe it out. That went on for a long time. And then we were both killed when the Cossack, mind you, the year was 1867 or 87, I don't know for sure, but it was about then, long time ago. So the Cossacks, those were the evil Russians came, and they burned half the town down, including our little house, and they killed both my mother and me. But when we walked over to the other side, and there is another side, we walked over there, she went off, and I decided that I wanted to talk to the people in charge. And I said, you made a big mistake because you gave me talent to paint and draw, but I was never allowed to draw, not in a religion that won't let you make people.
Okay,
no,
Renate, we're going to have to take a break here. Hold that thought. We'll pick up the story when we come back. This is Donna Sebo.
Okay.
This is a special interview, and these are her real experiences that any one of us could have. So in her sharing them, I think you're able to see through a portal that perhaps one day you may experience yourself. So I hope you'll stay for the rest of the show. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break, quick one, and then we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Rio, host of the Hooked on Raw radio show on rawenergyradio.com. If you're interested in the raw and living food lifestyle, along with the real story of what's happening to our health freedoms, and you don't mind a little controversy, listen to my radio show and podcasts on rawenergyradio.com. Each week, we interview guests and cover topics you won't hear on mainstream radio. Get informed, healthy, and involved. rawenergyradio.com.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Renate finishes her story. Just a moment, hon. What I want to do is quickly let those of you know in the Pacific Northwest, this is where Renate is, and she's in the Woodinville area, but the Northwest Women's Show is coming up on March 4th, 5th, and 6th, and I'm going to be there in booth number 407. On Friday the 4th, I'm going to be hosting a woman's forum, having six fabulous speakers, and I will hope that you'll come by. You'll be able to get all the information on the Northwest Women's Show by going to their site, thenorthwestwomensshow.com. You'll have all kinds of information there, and I'll be giving you more information as we get closer and closer. Don't forget, I'll be in booth number 407. I'll also be giving lectures on Saturday and Sunday. Okay, Renate, let's get to the rest of what happened, this woman's telling you about past life.
Oh, the past life, well, you see, they agreed with me, apparently. I don't remember it, but this is what I heard later, that I had a reason to complain, and therefore I was born again, 1924, to an artist family, where immediately I got lots of art lessons and you know, art supplies for my birthday. And then, at the age of 42, after Dixie was in my life, I began to paint the 39, The Lost World of the Shtetl, which was went to many, many museums and was shown all over the West. I can't remember all of the museums. In fact, some of them still have it in permanent collection. And after that, I was told that I can now paint the world of the shtetl because the memories, they put them into my head. I had no memory of a shtetl. I've never been in one, not in this life. But every day when I painted those, the memories kept coming back clearer and clearer. Until now, I am 87 years old. I have painted the lost world of the shtetl. Many, many shtetls. They're all over the place. Shtetls are little Jewish villages, that's what they're called. They're small paintings of a world that was once, that is no more, but it's now back in everybody's house. It's like, who was that guy? The guy that created apple trees. Yes.
Johnny Appleseed.
Thank you very much. So I'm now done. 10 minutes up.
Well, almost. Almost.
Almost.
But
then I'm still painting them. And as I told Donna, as I'm going to die in 3 or 4 years, probably 2 or 3 years, I will continue painting them on the other side. But
yes.
I definitely brought those little towns back.
Yes, you
and they're
did.
They're very pretty.
They really are, and there was one in your home that I saw that was a work in progress about a particular Jewish tradition about going to a certain lake and feeding the ducks.
Oh, yes, yes, and that's called Tashlik. It's called Tashlik. You go the day of Rosh Hashanah, you go to a running river or a lake that's moving, and you throw bread in for every sin that you have. Instead of going to the priest, you open up your prayer book and you pick out your sins. You know, like this is for the sin of gossip, and this is for the sin of this, this is for the sin of jealousy, and you throw bread in, and the ducks are very happy.
Oh, yes, a lot of little fat ducks floating around on that water pond saying, whoopee, sorry that this only comes once a year.
The Jews are here again.
Renata, you have shared so much of your life history, and I know that there is a great deal more. And we're almost out of time, but I have such an appreciation for you and people like you. I've interviewed a number of people in my 9 years of broadcasting to date that have survived the horrors of the Holocaust have written books and have wanted to share their stories, and I've been so privileged to do that. But with yours, you're so psychic anyway, and you have such an attunement to life. And with what you experienced when you were just a small child with your dad after he'd been shot,
walking right through
and lifting you up and, you know, literally saying goodbye. And then you have that rich memory. And then to go through what you went through for so many years and to hear and see and be a part of that line of trucks going into Germany that was Patton's line, because he was the general at the front of the long line of trucks.
Oh, yeah, he was so much in front that it was miles away from our little truck.
Mm-hmm. But little
you know,
did
was
you
such
know
a long line, long line.
Yes,
oh, long
that
line.
you were living. You're a living history book of a segment of experience. And not only are you a history book in that sense, but also that you were given memories of a time frame of a past life, a lifestyle that doesn't exist anymore, that is remembered because of your work. And
yes, but it's so
amazing.
Nice that they did that. That was so nice. And in the end, the last year when I was working on those 39, it took 3 years to paint them. When the last year, it came with smell and noise. I used to hear the horses and I could smell them when they had to go urinate on the cobble.
Right.
I could smell it. It was incredible how clear they brought those memories back in my head. For three years, I painted memories.
That's right. And you're going to be continuing, which I think is a tremendous testimonial to the fact that you have such a zest for life, and that though you're 87... you are continuing to share your talents with people. In fact, your commissions, you may not be able to pass away in 2 or 3 years, dear, if you keep getting all these commissions.
I'm going to have to. I was told that I was going to go at 2013. And if I'm going to live longer, I'm going to look like, you know.
Oh,
my daughter says, egg on your face, right.
Oh, Renata, you're just a doll. Now, there is a website where you can see some of her art, and this is how her name is spelled, RenataDollinger, art.
Dollinger, art.
Art. Right,
art.
So Renata...
.com.
Yes, .com. And you can see her art. The book that she illustrated is there as well. But this is a woman who is known by many, including Steven Spielberg and some other very famous personalities. And I'm so glad that you were with me today, Renate. Thank you so much for being my guest. Again, her website is Renate Dollinger Art, and do go check it out, because this woman is doing just as well at her art at 87 as she did when she started at 42.
Thank you. Thank you for your words. But I have a little arthritis today.
No, that's okay. You can have that. That's all right. We allow you to have that. Donna Siebel. All right there. I love you. This is Donna Siebel. Yeah. We've got to go. We're almost out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna. Let Renata be an inspiration to you. This is a very special program. I feel very privileged that I've had her as a guest, and I feel privileged to have you as my audience. Thank you so much. God bless. We'll be back with you tomorrow, and we'll be talking about food and how we can maintain wellness with Kitty Rossotti. Don't miss it. We'll be back tomorrow. Same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.